Thanks, Dana. Thanks to everybody for coming out. It's a real treat for me to introduce our third speaker this morning, my friend and colleague Neil Shubin. As I've gotten to know Neil over the years, I come to think, I'm not sure Neil is actually just one person. He's a paleontologist, that's for sure, and he's done trailblazing work on all sorts of topics around the world, on the reptile-mammal transition and the origin of tetrapods. But he's also a developmental biologist, and I think he may be the only scientist in the world who mounts expeditions as well as embryos. So you just don't, I would say, you know, probably 15 years ago, paleontologists and developmental biologists didn't even know each other, let alone to find such skills embodied in a single individual. So there's been dramatic changes in evolutionary science in terms of its personnel and the relationships among people doing evolutionary science. And even the fact that I know Neil so well is a reflection of a big change. But Neil is also, he's Associate Dean for Organismal and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Chicago. So that seems to be a reasonably complete job description, except for he's also provost of the Field Museum in Chicago, which comes with very heavy responsibilities. And so clearly, this is at least four people in one pair of shoes. And somehow, in his abundant spare time, he's also an author. And he's author of the new and critically acclaimed book, Your Inner Fish. So fresh from a grueling book tour, The Colbert Report, if you happen to catch it, and to tell us how to find our inner fish, please welcome Neil Shubin.
Thank you, Sean. Thanks, Sean, and thank you, Dana, for the invitation to come today. You know, to some extent, we're here to celebrate an idea that's over 150 years old. And that 150-year-old idea allows us to make predictions about the natural world, from fossils in the rocks of the Arctic, which I'm going to tell you about in a few minutes, to the DNA in every cell of our bodies. I mean, how beautiful is that? That an idea that was around before the discovery of DNA, before even genetics was known, allows us to make sense of all that. Anyway, before I start to well up and cry on you, let me talk about what I've been working on for the last 25 years. Now, that's really scary when I say that. I've been working on this for 25 years. I sound like a monomaniac. But anyway, when I was in graduate school, this problem caught my eye, the transition from fish to amphibian. And some of the people in the room here I actually went to graduate school with, and we used to sit in the office as graduate students and sort of just talk about this problem and how to really understand it. And this is sort of a textbook version of the fish to amphibian transition from a very wonderful textbook written by Len Radinsky in 1987. And it more or less showed the state of affairs at that time. What you have is a lobe-finned fish from about 380 million years ago. And on the bottom, you have an early limbed animal, a tetrapod, amphibian-like creature, from about 365 million years ago. So fish to amphibian. And what we knew at the time, and there was no doubt, that tetrapods, all land-living animals, are related to one group of fish known as lobe-finned fishes. Okay? But what we didn't know at that time were a lot of the details about how this process happened. Now, how did the limbs evolve from fins? How about this transformation of the head and the origin of many other structures in the bodies of amphibians? How did they come about in fish? So what I started doing in the 80s was really to think about, you know, how to get to this problem. Well, it really came down to finding new fossils. And indeed, what we had to do was really go to new sites. We couldn't go to places where people necessarily have discovered fossils before. What I really was after was to find whole new fossil sites that could provide us a whole new window on how this transition happened. So what we did is we sort of applied this sort of paleontological textbook to try to go about and do this. What we looked for in our planning was places in the world that had rocks of the right age. So from this problem, really, it became clear we wanted rocks somewhere around the age of 380 to 365 million years ago. Okay, that's the late Devonian. We also thought, you know, you need rocks of the right type. And as a paleontologist, we have a sort of a general idea of the kinds of rocks that are most likely to preserve fossils. These are obviously sedimentary rocks, which aren't superheated or formed under high pressure and so forth. But also we had an idea of the right environments to look at, the right ancient environments, namely ancient deltas, streams, lakes, things like that. Finally, there's a third criterion to finding new fossil sites, and that is, it does me no good if my great rocks are 5 miles underground. They have to be exposed to the surface, right? So is it any mystery when you read National Geographic, paleontologists tend to love deserts? That's because they can see acre or mile after mile of exposed bedrock. Okay, that's the textbook. The reality is, I started all this because I didn't have a whole lot of money. And so this is the state of Pennsylvania. And I started my first academic job here in southeastern Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And as a new young assistant professor, this was in the late 80s, early 90s, as a young assistant professor, you have the sort of the requirement to develop a new research program, but you don't have a ton of money. And you also want a stable research program, something you can do without a lot of money. You can do it on weekends and so forth. So in looking at a geological map of Pennsylvania, it became pretty clear that there's a research program here. What's in purple are Devonian age rocks, rocks of more or less the right age to understand the transition from fish to amphibian. It got even better when we looked at what the ancient environments suggested by those rocks were. Now, if you want to think about Pennsylvania in the late Devonian at about 365 million years ago, get Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, and Philadelphia out of your brain and think Amazon Delta. This is a cartoon of what it looked like. You had a highlands to the east and an inland sea to the west and a series of rivers and streams that drained from east to west. Now, if you're a paleontologist interested in the transition from fish to amphibian, this is perfect because you can sample the ancient oceans, ancient estuaries. You can even work your way up all the way upstream, you know, if you have the right rocks exposed. Ah, and that therein lies the problem with Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is not a desert, unfortunately, for paleontologists. So my research program, along with Ted Deschler, who was a graduate student with me at the time and now is an eminent paleontologist on his own, our research program became to follow the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation around when they blew up rocks to make new roads. So what we'd do is we'd get a list of where road sites were being developed in Pennsylvania, where they'd widen roads and so forth, and we'd map that to the geological map to get a sense of, are these the promising areas to go? And Ted and I would get in our station wagons, you can see one of them right there, and climb these cliffs. You've seen a lot of these rocks if you've driven across like Route 80 in Pennsylvania, like the red rocks you see there. More often than not, they're Devonian age rocks. Anyway, what you see here is what we spent, started in the early 90s, excuse me, what you see here is a human being for scale, cars, and you see this beautiful site though actually is layer after layer. These are the strata, the layers of rock, and this is that ancient delta system. These layers reflect a portion of the life history of an ancient stream, okay? As it meanders, as it dries, as it forms again. This was beautiful. As soon as we got to this kind of site, this is about, an hour north of State College in Pennsylvania. As soon as we got to this site, boom, we started to find fossils along the sides of the roads. The first thing we started to find were like giant teeth the size of railroad spikes, like the size of your thumb. I mean, many of these things. Then we started to find jaws of these animals. This is the front end of the jaws. This is Ted's hands here for scale. And this is one of the front ends of the jaws of one of these animals. The jaws turned out to be as long as your arm, with teeth the size of railroad spikes. This whole animal, which we were getting in pieces, not as the whole skeleton, was about 16 feet long. You know, trucks are whizzing by. Get this scene. Trucks are whizzing by. And here we're pulling these giant monsters out of the road cuts. Of course, you have big predatory fish, and then we found lots of little armored fish, like this guy here. Here's a skull of an armored fish, and it's its scales. We found lots of these things. And then, after about a couple, actually months, and then a few years later, we found some really good bones. After a little while, we started to find early limbed animals. Bits and pieces of them, though. This is one we described a few years back, but what we saw is this is an arm bone, an upper arm bone, known as the humerus, an upper arm bone of an early land-living creature. What was remarkable about this is it was a dead ringer for upper arm bones of early limbed animals that were known from Greenland at the time, than from Devonian age sediments that people had discovered back in the 20s and 30s. So what we had out of Pennsylvania was the beginnings of a research project that was allowing us to see an ancient world. And what you see is a reconstruction Ted and I did with National Geographic in the late 90s. To give you a sense of what this part of Pennsylvania looked like 365 million years ago. You had some of the earliest forests. These are some of the earliest plants with tree habit. Small shrubby kinds of creatures. Series of small streams. Here's that giant predator I was telling you about before. You had a couple forms like this, a couple creatures. We had lots of small armored fish. And then we had those bits and pieces, the evidence I showed you earlier, of early limbed animals. A remarkable world was emerging on the sides of these roads in Pennsylvania. And it was very informative for us because we're picking up not only early tetrapods or early limbed animals, early amphibians, but lobe fin fish as well, which can tell us a little about the transition from fish to amphibian. But it was getting to be about mid-90s when we realized we had a problem. And part of the problem was we were in rocks that were too young. They were too recent. Because we're already picking up early tetrapods, early limbed animals. What it was very clear is that TED9 needed to move back in time, maybe as much as about 10 million years, to really try to find intermediate creatures that sort of bridge that gap, if you will, between fish and amphibian. And really, because the problems we were after were anatomical ones as much as anything. And just to give you a sense of the problems, let me just show you a few anatomy slides to give you a sense of what we're dealing with. This is that Radinsky slide I showed you earlier with a 380-million-year-old lobe fin fish on top and an early limbed animal. This one's from Greenland on the bottom about 365 million years ago. And what you see is big differences in the body between a fish and amphibian. Just look at the head. You know, these early lobe fin fish have a conical head with eyes on either side. Early limbed animals, like many amphibians, have a flat head with eyes on top. Even more so, when you look at the back of the head, there's these little notches here that ultimately become the ears. Fish don't have necks. They have a series of bones in the head which connect to the shoulder. So when a fish wants to bend its head, it has to bend its body, right? It's not really good. If you want to look over here, you go forward, right? That's good for, it's not good for us. We can move our head. We can swivel it relative to our bodies because we have a neck which actually appeared in these early limbed animals for the first time, where the head is actually separate from the shoulder. You've lost those bones that connect it, and you've actually formed a series of joints in the vertebrae. Okay, so a neck is another big feature. And obviously, the feature you think about when you compare fish to amphibians is fish have fins. Early limbed animals have, just as the word says, have limbs. They have with fingers and toes and wrists and ankles. And what we were finding in Pennsylvania, Ted and I were already finding creatures that have this stuff. Flat heads, fingers, toes, wrists, ankles, necks, and all that. So we really wanted to see how this developed. And so if we sort of looked at, in the mid-90s, what we knew, this is kind of the tree, the evolutionary tree. These are tetrapods, you're here, limbed animals, literally four-legged animals. And these are the fish we and other people were finding from around the world that are successively more closely related to tetrapods. But there's a gap. We had these, but there's a real gap in trying to bridge the anatomy, particularly of understanding the origin of the wrists, the origin of the neck, the origin of a variety of different skull structures. And when you map it on time, this is pretty clear. There was a big question mark. And so there's that assemblage of fish that extended in age from about 380 to 390 million years ago. And the earliest tetrapods, as I was telling you before, were 365, 363, something like that. And so there's a large gap in our knowledge. So Ted and I wanted to bridge that gap. We wanted to find rocks at that question mark in age. So this is the mid-90s. We started a very systematic search. Remember I told you those three criteria: rocks of the right age, rocks of the right type, and exposures. So what we did is we started to look at geological maps, geological surveys done by countries, oil and gas surveys and so forth, satellite photos. And, you know, if you walked into our offices in the mid-90s, you would have seen stacks after stacks of maps and geological publications. That actually led nowhere. What actually led to the discovery, which I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, was an argument I had with Ted Deschler in the winter of 1998. I remember the day as vividly as today, as this morning. I mean, Ted and I were arguing, and to stop the argument, I grabbed an undergraduate geology textbook, this textbook. This textbook is so outrageously out of date. Those who were geologists would know that. But to end, that's what I had nearby. I just wanted to stop it. So I opened the book. I'm paging through it. And in going through this textbook, I found a figure that was to change the course of my research for the next 10 years. And Ted's. We both looked at this figure, just dumbstruck. And it's worth spending a little time on this figure because it tells you what we look for in a nutshell. This is like figure 14-something from that textbook. It says, Upper Devonian Sedimentary Facies. In English, that means rocks of more or less the right age and possibly the right type. Okay. Anyway, so what you see is a map more or less of North America. Here's the U.S., here's Mexico, Canada, Greenland, Canadian Arctic. And superimposed on that is a map of sort of the ancient, what the assumption was, of ancient environments from the late Devonian.
So there's the postulate that there is an ancient Devonian ocean in the, more or less the western part of the western North America. And then the authors saw places where they proposed where ancient deltas, like the Amazon Delta, existed in the Devonian. And there were three. There's one in eastern North America. Well, that wasn't news to Ted or I. We had been working there for many years, right? There is another, East Greenland. Well, that wasn't news to anybody either, because remember I told you the early amphibians were from Devonian Age rocks of East Greenland? This is where Swedish and Danish teams from the 20s and 30s discovered, you know, some remarkable fossils at the cusp of the transition, early tetrapods. Then, as you could probably tell, there's a third area here, extending 1,500 kilometers east to west across the Canadian Arctic. I looked at Ted, he looked at me, I said, Ted, anybody's been up there? I don't know either. So we're like, wow. And so we got on the internet, and we were looking this up, and it turns out the Canadian oil and gas geologists had mapped this stuff beautifully in the 70s. Yet not a single of our vertebrate paleontology colleagues knew about it. We couldn't believe our luck. And so this is the this is from one of those papers that I sort of colorized it. So what we're dealing with here is Nunavut territory, which is in the Canadian Arctic. Here's the North Pole. This is Nunavut, the territory here. There's a nice little flag. Anyway, so you have, there's Ellesmere Island. Zoom in on Ellesmere Island. Boom, right here. Okay, and these are the Western Arctic Islands. This is where the Devonian Age rocks, late Devonian Age rocks, were shown to be exposed by the Canadian geologists. Furthermore, this is a geological section here of it, is Devonian. The formation we are interested in is called the Fram Formation. For a lot of reasons, the guy who described it, Ashton Embry, the great Canadian geologist who did this work in the 70s, he described the Fram Formation as identical to the Catskill Devonian of eastern North America. They're like, whoa, couldn't believe our luck. And then it was dated at 375 million years old. Okay, remember that question mark I showed you before? These are the rocks we were looking at, boom, at the question mark. Okay, exposed over about 1,500 kilometers. I mean, it was truly remarkable. So Ted and I were, this all happened in the course of a morning in the winter of 1998, and Ted and I were like shaking when we saw this. Really, I mean, this is what you live for. And so we went to a, as a paleontologist, I should say, we went to a Chinese food restaurant for lunch. And we were like high-fiving each other during lunch. People were looking at us like we're crazy. And I had a fortune cookie. I opened the fortune cookie, and it said, soon you will be at the top of the world. And I was like, okay, we're out of here. We're going to the Arctic. So it wasn't quite that easy. That was the winter of 1998. We didn't make our first trip up to the Arctic until summer of 1999. You know, so basically, you know, you're here, right? I mean, it's like, I were working here out of my little Subaru in the 90s, right? I couldn't get my Subaru. It had a lot of four-wheel drive, but it would not get up there. In the summer, it's 24 hours of daylight. The winter, it's 24 hours of darkness. You know, logistics is fairly severe. You have to get food up there, a crew up there. You have to get the crew home and the fossils home. That's big. There's lots of danger working up there. But also, you only have about 5 weeks. It's July. Maybe a week in June and maybe a week in August if you're really lucky. I mean, so you really have a window. to give you a sense of the logistic challenges, this is the nearest town. It's about 150 miles away. This is a picture of it in spring. It has about 170 people. It gives you a sense of what we're dealing with. So it took us about a year and a half to get there for the first time, just because the permits were tough and raising money and just figuring out what we're doing, how we're going to do this. So turns out the way you get around up there is, you know, you can take a jet to southern Baffin Island. So it's about 3,000 miles north of where we are, right? So you fly a jet for about 1,500 miles north, and then you fly these little planes and stuff. So this is the plane that's the workhorse of the Canadian Arctic. It's called a Twin Otter, made by de Havilland Canada. Remarkable. If you've been in the bush, you've probably been on this plane, this kind of plane. Remarkable planes. They have a stall speed of 55 miles an hour. So when you take off, it does not feel natural. I mean, you're going way too slowly. But you can pack this pretty well with gear, and it can land on the tundra with these giant balloon tires. Our sites are very remote, so we have to do these shuttles between the twin otters and the helicopters. And helicopters are actually quite limited on weight. And the reason why I'm going through this is we can't bring a lot of stuff up. And more importantly, we can't bring a lot of stuff home. Fossils are heavy. Okay, so one of our challenges in working in the Arctic is really deciding what stays in the Arctic and what comes home.
these people come home, okay? That's
this is camp. I mean, the good news is they're all very small, which helps because we have to minimize our weights up there. But so we pack our food. This is what camp looks like before we unfurl it. You know, so I'm always, this is the time of year I'm planning the expedition for this summer, and I'm trying to think about how I can optimize weight down to the 10-pound limit. It's really sort of an optimization game. So we pack food in these tubs, which is good. They don't carry smells. Polar bears are out here, so that's not good. And so we try to limit the smells. And then we try to be compact and so forth. And the scientific challenge really is, it's almost like a salvage operation when you're up there. If you find a site, you have to make a really rapid decision. Is this fossil coming home? Is it worth spending time on to bring it home? Or does it stay? And part of the problem is you never really know when you're right. Well, you know when you're right. You never know when you're wrong. That's the problem. Anyway, so we started in 1999 here in the western part of the Arctic. We're really excited. I mean, we had the fortune cookie. We had everything behind us. We go in 1999, and this is what camp looked like in 99. Here is our personal tents. Everybody lives in their own little personal tent. These can withstand huge winds. They're remarkable. This is the kitchen tent. It's not remarkable. It cannot withstand huge winds. I know that. And so what we like to do is pitch underneath snowfields, because you can drink the water, you can get ice and so forth. But what you see here is the Devonian exposure. So you can see how it's laid out kind of flat. What we do is each day, really, to begin the expedition, is we walk back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And what you're looking for is where bone is weathering out on the surface. Because that's where you know to dig in. So we're just basically looking for bits of fish bone as we walk over these exposures. 1999 was really remarkable for one thing. That we found absolutely nothing. It was a complete failure on a lot of levels. One level is we actually dropped off in the wrong part of the Arctic. We were in the middle of the ancient ocean, deep water sediments which would not necessarily preserve the fossils we were interested in. We really wouldn't know that unless we were there. And that was good experience because of the year. We learned the logistics, we learned how to work in the Arctic, and we learned what not to look at in the Arctic. And then the other piece is we had really lousy weather. We had 2 weeks of bad weather where we were stuck in these tents, and it was kind of disappointing, mind-numbing. But we made the decision to go back in 2000. And so in 2000, we moved east. And so remember, it's like a delta system, more or less, where you have streams that drain from east to west. So we've essentially moved upstream in the ancient world here. So we moved to southern Ellesmere Island. And this is what camp looked like in southern Ellesmere. It was more mountainous. So we could walk up and down these cliffs. These look kind of spooky to climb. They're not. Actually, they're very soft, and you can go up and down. And that's what we spent our time doing. And boom, as soon as we moved east, we started to find lobe-fin fish. It was really great. We got into the right environment. So it was sort of a classic that way. And the problem is with 2000 is we really didn't end up with much of anything either because a lot of the stuff we were finding was already known. And this is where we've been working most recently, just to give you a sense of what camp looks like. And here's camp. But this is kind of what we look for. When I look at an aerial photo or whatever of a place to drop a camp, I'm looking for exposure that's laid out like this. You can see how these are the layers. And you just walk back and forth. They're accessible to you. They'll erode in the right way to preserve fossils. And so this is kind of what we spend our time doing. Okay, so here's how we found what we found. This is the day the fossil site I'm going to tell you about was discovered, before it was discovered, with a discoverer who didn't know it. Yeah, here's Jason Downs, okay, an undergraduate college student from the University of Pennsylvania, wanted to be a paleontologist. He actually is a paleontologist now. He's a postdoc, graduated from Yale last year as a PhD. Jason, this is 3 hours before he was to make the discovery of a lifetime. He just finished lunch, and he was going to walk over these cliffs a few hours later. What he did was this. He walked up the hills, and he walked to this. See how there's a green layer here, sort of a greenish thing? The reason why it's green is it's covered with thousands upon thousands upon thousands of fish bones, broken up pieces. Jason was to walk on this, and it was a really amazing story. He was late coming back to camp that night, and that's actually a cause for concern in the Arctic. We usually go out in teams of two, and if someone gets separated, you're worried, and if they're late, you're really worried. And so it was running around 6:30 or 7 o'clock, which is when we want everybody back, and Jason was already late. And then we hear the tent rattle. Oh, Jason comes in, his eyes are like globes. And, is he being chased by a polar bear? No, he's okay. It was immediately clear what the reason was. If you looked at his pockets, he had pockets here, he had pockets here, he had pockets here, loaded with fish bones everywhere. He's pulling them out on the table and just laying them out. And he was just shaking. He was so excited. And obviously, when we saw Jason's haul, we were excited too.
And so this is that evening. So we took the, we said, dinner, forget about it. We grabbed the chocolate bar. And we ran to Jason's site, which is about a mile away down the valley. And this is, these are the kinds of bones Jason was finding. These are like plates of a lobe-fin fish, lungfish kind of thing. There are versions of these things around today, actually. So now our goal became, okay, this was the end of the season, and we needed to find where Jason's bones were coming from. They were littered all over the surface. But we had to crawl. This here's Jason's cliff, so we're crawling. Here's us. We're crawling right about here. We wanted to find the layer. You'd think, well, you know, fossils roll down the hill, no big deal. There's no rocket science. You can find where they're coming from. The reality is it was really tough. And it's really tough because of the way Arctic rocks weather, at least in this part of the world, this part of the Arctic. What happens, you see these cracks here? What that is, churned upper layer, almost like a proto-soil layers. The upper layers are all churned up, so you can't identify layers. And the reason why everything churns up so much is the Arctic is really, really, really cold in the wintertime. And in the summer, it's less really, really cold. So it goes really, really cold, less really, really cold, and you get that so almost a version of a freeze-thaw, which churns up the upper layers, which meant a lot of the tools we were using to try to identify layers based on from, you know, Pennsylvania or my experience in the American West, they didn't work here. So we went home at the end of this season, this is 2000, with a place with tons of little bones on the surface, but no layer identified yet. And we were really frustrated, actually. But the decision was made to go back in 2002. We went back in 2002, and this is my colleague Ted Deschler. And what we did in 2002 is identify the layer. In the first couple weeks, we did it. And then here's the layer as it became exposed. This is a site about 25 feet across. And as we exposed this layer, we started to find whole skeletons of fish, one on top of the other. That was really cool. And until we brought everything home in 2002, and it turned out pretty much everything was known from somewhere else in the world before. Nothing was new. So we were left with the decision in 2002. We've been learning lessons the whole time, right? It's been useful failures. I mean, we're getting closer and closer. We're learning the ways to work in this place. We had now had a site. We had lots of bones in it. The decision was made. We were running out of money and patience, but in 2002, the decision was one last go at it, a really good go at this particular site. So here we are in July 2004. And this is 2006. This shows you what the area looks like. Camp is tucked back in the valley here. This is Jason's site after we opened it up. This is what it looked like 2 summers ago. How big the hole was. Most remarkable moment of my field career was in the first week of the field season in July 2004. And this is my colleague Steve Gatesy, who was picking rocks from that hole I was showing you. And he picked a rock from here, and this is what he saw. Here's the rocks. You see the red rocks. Those are the Devonian rocks. And you can see something here. Do you see this? There's like a bar here. There's another one right here. There's something there. He said, guys, what's this? And so it's a small hole. We all ran over to it. And it became very clear what it was. It was the front end of a snout of a flat-headed fish. It was the front end of a snout of a flat-headed animal sticking out of the rock. Now, remember I showed you before? Conical head, flat head? The minute we saw the flathead, we knew we were onto it. Okay, it was really remarkable. This is what we were there to do. And so the job for the remainder of the season, remember the snout was sticking out of the hill. If we had any luck, the skeleton would be buried in the rest of the cliff. So here's what Steve did about 2 weeks later after he found them. He basically roughed it out. See how he roughed it out? So this thing can travel home within the rock. My colleague, Eric Jenkins, as Steve was roughing it out, he found another one of these creatures. I was working down the hall right about here. I found another one. And we had a fourth that came out a little bit later that was just rolling out of the hill. We had four of these flat-headed fish coming out in July 2004. It's really remarkable. Now the trick became to get them home. Problem is we bring these things home in plaster, and that's another technical challenge. Is the weather's kind of lousy. Plaster doesn't like to dry in snow and sleet. So we had to set up a little drying kiln. That's a camp stove that we use for drying kiln. That's actually critical because the fossils come home at the bottom of a helicopter, right? So and it takes a lot of abuse. And so we want to make sure that they get back home safely. Anyway, the fall of 2004 rolled on, and these flat-headed animals, which are embedded in rock, get back to the laboratory. Now, imagine the laboratory. It's basically what we have is a series of microscopes, really highly trained preparators who use these tools, removing rock grain by grain to expose the bone.
And this is a Steve specimen, actually. Here's the plaster that's been opened up. After about 3 weeks, the pair, Fred and Philadelphia, Fred Mollison, was picking away the rock. And here's what he started to expose. You can see what's happening here. This is the Steve snout here. It looks like a flat-headed animal. There's a hole. There's a hole.
Orbits, where the eyes would be.
There's a back end of something.
3 months later, this is what it looked like.
See what's emerging here? Here's the front end of a head. There's one orbit. There's the other orbit. Wow, it looks like we even have a neck. Because here's one shoulder, and here's another shoulder. And there's maybe even a body on this animal.
Over about 5 months in the fall of 2004, in the winter of 2005, this animal was being revealed to us day by day as the Kitzmiller trial was going on in Dover, Pennsylvania. But remember, here's a fish. Here's an early amphibian, conical head, flat head. These guys have scales on their back and fins. These guys don't. Here's the new fish. This is the Steve's, the one I showed you as the snout before.
Flat head with eyes on top. Has a neck, has little notches where the ears would be. But look at this. Here's scales in its back, and there's the fin webbing. So like a fish, it has scales in its back and fin webbing. But like an early amphibian, it has a sort of a version of, it's the same flat head with eyes on top. Has a neck, which we now know from the internal joints. And it even got better when we opened up the fin. It has bones that correspond to our upper arm, forearm, even parts of our wrist and palm, shoulder, elbow, and wrist, as I'll show you in a second.
So what we had was a creature at about 375 million years ago, this is what we went up there to find, that sort of was filling this sort of gap in time. And it's a lobe-finned fish that has a melange of characters of tetrapods, limbed animals, and fish. It had fins, scales, and primitive jaws, which I didn't show you, but it does. And it has a variety of other features. It has wrists, it has a neck, it has a flat head, expanded ribs, part fish, part amphibian. Found at the right time. This is why we designed the expedition in the first place. Knowing something about the fossil record, knowing something about evolution, drove us to the Arctic to find something like this. Now we had the wonderful thrill of naming this animal. And so what we wanted to do is we were working in the Inuit lands, the Nunavut territory, and we wanted it to reflect its Inuit heritage, its provenance. And because we really worked there by the good graces of the Inuit people, so I consulted with the cultural elders of Nunavut, and the task was to design a name that reflects the creature, but is also a name that we could pronounce. Now, the name of the committee did not inspire a whole bunch of confidence that they would be able to give us a name that we could readily pronounce. So I was talking to this guy, I was trying to describe it to him. I said, well, yeah, there's fish inside rocks. He said, I don't get that one, but tell me where it lived. I said, well, it's a large freshwater fish. He says, oh, why don't you say so? You got yourself a tiktaalik. I said, what's a tiktaalik? He said, it's a large freshwater fish. he proposed another name. There's a synonym, which of a name I couldn't pronounce. We chose tiktaalik because it's a little easier on our tongues. Anyway, so we started to have several specimens of tiktaalik. And now the joy became to take them apart. You know, when you have lots of specimens, the smallest one's about, this is the head of Steve's specimen, the cast, you can see it later. It's about 4 feet long. We have the rest of the body, by the way. The biggest one's about twice this size, about almost 9 feet long, if you include the tail.
This is the big one we were preparing in Chicago. In fact, we're still preparing. It's a very slow process. It could take years to take these things apart. Here's an underside. You're looking at this view here, right? So here's one jaw. Here's another jaw, so you're looking at that underside. This is the gill area, so the branchial apparatus that supports the gills. This creature had both lungs and gills, I should say. Here's the shoulder. As we took this animal apart, we saw a shoulder, humerus, radius, ulna. We started to see the limb bones. And we took the limb bones apart.
And we started to do that, we found, you know, it has an upper arm bone, a humerus, has forearm bones, the radius and ulna. It has a proximal carpal or the proximal wrist joint, and it has a transverse joint distally. It has a wrist, what's called a distal carpal joint, which is a version of the joint we have in our wrist. It got even better. When we took these bones apart, we were able to look at the joint surfaces of this fish.
Here's the shoulder of this fish. This is the socket on the shoulder. Here's the head on the humerus, the upper arm bone. We could look to see how they're fit together and how it was used. We could look at the elbow. Here's the facets for the radius and ulna at the elbow. These are the facets in the ulna and radius here. They fit together. We can tell how these were moving relative. These are the wrist joints of this fish. You have to look at this matching surfaces.
When we did this, what we found is this animal is able to flex at the elbow and extend at the wrist, do a form of a push-up, which is interesting because it had a palm area. And this is an animal that was really clearly set up to do a form of a push-up. So in 2006, this is the sort of the reconstruction we were able to do. The head, flat head with eyes on top, had a neck, separate head and shoulder girdle, big, massive shoulder girdle, a fin with true fin webbing, really had fin webbing. But when you take that fin webbing out, you find bones that correspond to our upper arm, forearm, wrists. These are functional joints, as I showed you before. Had massive ribs that overlock with one another. This is what it looked like in 2004. We went back in 2006, and we found much of the hind end of the animal now, which we'll be describing soon, as pelvis, portions of the hind fin, and beyond. When this was announced in 2006, it got a lot of publicity, and other people started to do their reconstructions, namely Miss Philbin's third grade class in Manchester. It was really fun to work with the students as they. This is the big specimen. This is the 9-footer, not the little. And so Tiktaalik tells us a whole lot about the transition from life in water to life in land. What you have with Tiktaalik is a creature that has both fish characteristics and amphibian characteristics. Clearly, when we look at the environment it's living in a shallow stream. What we believe it's able to do with this ability to do a push-up, with the ability to use both lungs and gills, and to move its head, is to live on the water bottom, to live in the shallows, to live in the mudflats. That is exploiting that interface between water and land. Now, Tiktaalik tells us a whole lot about the transition from water to land. But to close, let me just tell you that that transition is not some esoteric branch of the evolutionary tree. That's a piece of our own history. When we talk about the origin of a neck in a creature like Tiktaalik, we're dealing with the origin of something that became our own neck. When we're dealing with the origin of a wrist in a creature like Tiktaalik, we're dealing with something that became our own wrist. And we can trace these through the phylogenetic or evolutionary tree of vertebrates, using fossils, using DNA, and using living creatures. It's a really remarkable piece of our own history. And that's why I called the book Your Inner Fish, because each one of us in our own bodies carries an evolutionary tree of life, if you will, inside of us. In every organ, in every cell, in every gene, there's that history. I could have called the book, Your Inner Fly or Your Inner Worm or whatever. Fish is great because fish, much of our body plan, at least in terms of its skeleton, actually traces to fish. Let's just close with showing that part of the body plan. If you're going to show the fish as it led to humanity, let's start with Albert Einstein. Start at the top. Albert Einstein was a really smart guy, and he had a really important equation, E equals mc squared. I am not as smart as Albert Einstein, but I have an equation too, and that is that Albert Einstein equals a bizarre kind of fish. And as well as all of us, as well as every dog and cat and reptile and so forth. And what I want to do is compare Professor Einstein to the humble fish. Einstein's on your left here. And just look at a couple features. Obviously, I showed you the appendages already. If you look at a human arm, we have, like every land living animal, we have one bone that goes to two bones, that goes to a series of small wrist bones that can flex transversely, and then the fingers. We begin to see how that pattern was set up in fish like Tiktaalik. And Tiktaalik's not the only fish that shows this. There are other fossils as well that show this assembly. Let's just look at the head. If you look at the first couple weeks post-conception in a human, like Einstein, what you have is a situation like this. These are the primordial eyes coming out. And then you have a series of swellings. You see these swellings here? And they're separated by little clefts. These are the famous gill arches. Well, if you look at a shark embryo or a fish embryo or a turtle embryo, you find the same thing. Now, the head might look somewhat different. You can see the shape is different. But they still have these eye primordia, and they still have these swellings separated by little clefts. What happens in a fish like a shark? Well, these arches form part of the front end of the head. Much of the wiring and the bones and the muscles and nerves of the head can be traced to this gill arch pattern. The first arch becomes portions of the upper and lower jaw. The second arch becomes portions of the bones that support them. And the other ones become gill arch supporting bones. Cells inside these things give rise to the muscles, nerves, arteries, and so forth that support the gill arches. What happens in humans? We have, starting from the same design, in the adult, the first arch gives rise to a jaw and parts of our ear bone. Second arch, jaw support structures, as well as an ear bone and parts of the skull. And the other ones form parts of the voice box. That is, bones that I'm using to talk to you with right now, and many of the bones, muscles, and nerves that you're using to listen to me right now, actually translate to structures that correspond to gill structures in fish. And I know that as sure as day from embryology and from as well as the DNA that controls this whole process, as well as fossils which support these transitions. three lines of evidence pointing to the same thing. It's a beautiful story. And that's the story of science nowadays, in that it has many, we use many lines of evidence to make our cases. It's also, if you look at our fish, our understanding something about fish allows us sometimes to understand like weird things in our bodies. Well, in males, that weird thing is that the testes sit in a scrotum. And so here's Einstein. And here's where Einstein's, we'll call human male testes sit, shown in green. What's odd here is that the spermatic cord, as it goes from the testes to the penis, takes a weird loop through the pelvis. That's a very, very unfortunate loop for us, for we males. The reason is that in the formation of that loop, portion of the male lower abdominal body wall is very weak. We're more susceptible to a certain kind of hernia than females are. So men are weaker than women in this particular area. And a lot of it is because of this weird loop. Why have this bizarre design? Well, look at the fish. Here's a shark, but I could show you any. Here's the gonad of a shark. They don't have that weird loop. Look where the testes sit in green here. It's up near the heart, up towards the chest. And the spermatic cord goes all the way down towards the cloaca. What happens in human males is we begin, much like the embryo of a shark or a fish, human males begin development with the testes not in a scrotum, but higher up towards the kidneys, much towards closer to the chest. And as we develop, we descend from the shared state we have with fish to a situation where the testes take this loop-de-loop. It's the famous descent of the testes, which you see in an embryo here. Now, you think descent of man. Well, yeah, it's descent of man. So here's the testes. They begin high up in the embryo, and then they descend, as you see, it descends to the scrotum. As it does that, it forms a weakness in the body wall. The reason is we begin our development much like an embryo of a shark. We have this commonality in embryonic stages to some extent, which you saw in the gill arches. We gain our mammalness, which is important for the formation of sperm, as the testes descend into this temperature control device, which we call a scrotum. Sperm are finicky things, and they need the right temperature to develop, at least mammalian sperm is. So this is an interesting case where history actually has led to its sort of unintelligent or inefficient design. And that history only makes sense when we begin to understand our shared history with fish and what we've done to be mammals on top of that fish body plan. Okay? And that's the story of your inner fish, but that's the story of evolution, is really understanding how every structure in our bodies, whether it's an organ, whether it's a cell, or whether it's a gene, has over 3 billion years of history inside it. That history means a lot for our past. But also, I should say, it means a lot for our future. And this is so true, it's almost trivial. That is, that we biologists work on odd organisms to tell us something about human health. That is, if you look at the Nobel Prizes in medicine or physiology over the last, say, 13 years, I shouldn't have called the book Your Inner Fish. It should be called Your Inner Worm, or Your Inner Yeast, Your Inner Sea Urchin, or something like that. 2 Nobel Prizes awarded to 5 people over the last few years have gone to people working on a tiny little worm with a small number of cells. That worm lives, you know, in the dirt. It's about the size of a comma on a piece of paper. Yet that worm is showing us how our own DNA works to build our bodies. And it's providing tools to cure human disease. I cannot imagine a more profound connection between us and the rest of life on our planet. And a more important one than that. And that's because of evolution. Thank you very much. Sure. Take questions. There's microphones around.
What was or was there a climatic or environmental shift that allowed Tiktaalik to survive? That is, was there something in the environment that allowed those variations to so the organism could flourish?
Yeah, good question. Why would Tiktaalik do something like it's doing? It helps to compare water to land at this time period. What was happening at this time period, late Devonian, was the development of really large predators in freshwater streams. You pretty much had 16-foot-long fish with teeth the size of railroad spikes. You had 10-foot-long fish with the heads the size of basketballs and teeth in every bone in their skull. You had a lot of voracious predators living in these ancient Devonian streams. I mean, we like to call it a fish-eat-fish world. And in something that's that predator-rich, there are a lot of strategies to survive. You can get big fish eat little fish. You can get armor or other strategies to avoid being eaten. And one of those big strategies to avoid being eaten is getting out of the way. So it may be intense predation was driving some of the differences we see. But you can't really ignore the fact that water is loaded with competitors, loaded with predators. It's also loaded with food. It has its matrix of benefits and costs, if you will. But land didn't really have a whole lot of vertebrate competitors. There were, the plants on land, there were invertebrates on land. So compare a predator-rich and also competitor-loaded environment, water, to a relatively competitor-free environment with no predators and rich food sources, that's land. It's easy to see why there is probably selection to creatures who could exist on land. In terms of climate change, there's some climate change going on in the Devonian, and some of it relates to the amount of oxygen and carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, which may be a factor of this as well. But most of us have been really thinking about biotic factors driving this as much as anything. You'll take a.
Do we know what Tiktaalik was eating?
Yeah, other fish and probably invertebrates. So if you look at here's the skull of Steve's Tiktaalik, okay, which you're welcome to come up and look at after the talk. These are its lower jaws. If you look at it, Tiktaalik has several rows of teeth. It has a small row of teeth on the outside, which are really sharp. They're conical things. And it has a lot of giant fangs, which typically in fish are used to grasp and to hold on to stuff and biting. So it was a predator. It was clearly able to eat other fish. But, it could eat, the invertebrates at this time were pretty luscious, large nuggets. So it could conceivably eat those. There's a question on this side.
I have a comment first and then a question. The comment is that there are much newer editions of F textbook.
I know.
The question, would you say just a little bit about comparison?
But that's the one I bought when I was a student. So.
Good for you. I'd be interested in a little more detailed comparison with the famous East Greenland book.
Yeah, the famous East Greenland. So, if you look at the East Greenland stuff, it's younger. And it's thought to be sort of more intermontane basin rather than the open delta system that the Canadian Arctic is. But, if you look at the sediments up there, they're very similar. What we're finding the fossils in mostly are overbank sediments, margins of the streams, which are the classic ones that paleontologists would typically work on. But we're probably about 7 to 10 million years older than the famous East Greenland sites. I should say that the East Greenland sections actually go back into the front end. So if someone wanted a research program, go up into there are older rocks up there to look at. It's just logistically difficult.
What about the skeletal differences?
Yeah, so the skeletal difference is Acanthostega and Ichthyostega, which are the fossils that come out of there. Ichthyostega and Acanthostega both have true fingers, which Tiktaalik does not have. Tiktaalik has small bones that have joints between them, okay? But they don't have the long one at the base, which is what, like a metacarpal or metatarsal. So that's the difference there, one of the big differences. The other big difference is that the fossils they're finding in East Greenland don't have the fin webbing. So it seems like what they've done is traded the fin, they've lost the fin webbing, early tetrapods, but then develop sort of longer digits in its place. So it's the idea being that you go from having something that's really kind of a paddle to actually something that can actually conform to a complex substrate, if you will. There are differences in the head as well. The head is as flat as this, but what you're doing is also changing the proportions between front and back. You'll notice you have a pretty long area in front of the orbit and a short area behind the orbit. That's actually even more exaggerated in the creatures up and from Greenland. And this notch becomes a little deeper. It's basically accentuating the trend you see if you compare Tiktaalik to Eusthenopteron, which is the lobe-fin fish further down the tree. It's sort of accentuating some of these proportional changes we see.
Where was the land mass that you excavated at the time these fish were there? Things migrated around the globe. Was it in a warmer area?
Yeah, good question. Yeah, you're pointing out yes, it was closer to the equator, much closer, actually sub-equatorial. So, which really is this great disconnect, right, which you always see as a geologist between present and past. Here we're in the Arctic, there's tropical plants coming out of the rocks, which is one of those remarkable things. So it was much more closer to the equator. It had rotated up north and sort of the whole continent rotated a bit. There was a question, yeah.
If I understand your answer to the second question about competition, that there was maybe less competition on land for survival than there was in the water?
Less competition from vertebrates. Yeah, absolutely, because there's no other creature on land. There's nothing on land other than invertebrates and plants.
The impression I get as a non-scientist or citizen is that there were a lot of dinosaurs and a lot of competition and violence going on.
We're a long time before dinosaurs. So we're dealing with 375 million years ago. You know, dinosaurs, we're seeing them hitting the scene around 200 million years ago. So we're actually 160 million years before dinosaurs. So when you look at this world that's 160 million years, 170 million years before dinosaurs, what you're seeing is a world that does not look the same. We're so used to seeing ecosystems that have a structure that we are used to today. We're so used to seeing a world that has, you know, it's filled with the same kinds of species that we think today. It's actually not the case. That ecosystem itself was assembled over time as animals evolved and the trophic levels were filled out and so forth. So yeah, no dinosaurs on land. Nothing. No. There's bug-like things and plants. Oh, and microbes, of course. They're everywhere. And lichens. And, yeah, I could add to that, but that's right. I'll stop while I'm ahead. Yes, there's a question in the front.
Is there any direct evidence that this critter ever got onto land? It seems to me that the forelimbs could be using for pushing off the bottom,
yes,
moving around in shallow water. But, I mean, I thought maybe you might have some...
No, I mean, let me just answer your question first. So this had fins with limbs. So we're thinking this thing was actually living in the interface. I don't think it was a terrestrial organism at all. It still had gills. So what you're dealing with at Tiktaalik is clearly a creature that's exploiting an interface. If you think of walking, supporting yourself on the bottom in a current, living in the shallows, or existing on the mudflats for a while, the same mix of characters are good for all that sort of stuff. Indeed, this thing had lungs as well, but those lungs could be used for breathing in anoxic waters, just like lungfish today, or on land. So, no, we're thinking, you know, that really this thing is adapting for aquatic environments, perhaps that interface between water and land. The first footprints of creatures on land don't appear till a little bit later than Tiktaalik, you know, the first true sort of trackways. Yes, there's a question for
you. Mm-hmm. And that oxygen increased in the atmosphere to allow the transition from no body to body.
Yeah, bodies are expensive, right? I mean, Sean Carroll has had students and postdocs. Sean's thought of this for a long time. The bodies are really expensive to have in a lot of ways, particularly our kinds of bodies, because for cells to interact with one another in certain ways, there have to be molecules that connect the cells for the cells to talk to one another, but there also have to be molecules that lie between the cells that sort of form the support structure for bodies. And that's what makes our muscles different from our bones and so forth. It turns out that one of the support molecules that we use, collagen, is kind of expensive in terms of oxygen metabolism. And so one of the notions is that you had the toolkit to develop bodies for a long period of time. Microbes doing their business were developing, the cellular tools. And, you know, microbes can sense their environment and avoid predation and eat other creatures. And in doing that, they've developed the molecular toolkit, if you will, to allow bodies to happen. But the reason why we see bodies is perhaps due to an environmental evolving more or less at that same time in many different lineages is because the environmental trigger, in this case, oxygen, which allowed things to get large, organisms to have collagen, which is expensive. So. But also oxygen is dangerous, too. Organisms have to avoid oxygen. It can be a killer as well. So you have this fine balance between oxygen, the metabolic molecule, but oxygen also the molecule that can lead to physiological distress. Yes?
I was just wondering if you believe that Tiktaalik was limited to the environment you found it in, and I was wondering why you were unable to find it in Pennsylvania and Greenland.
Yeah, so... I think the real reason for Pennsylvania and Greenland, despite not finding it, is because that's about 15 million years, 10 to 15 million years later in both cases, maybe a little less, 8 to 15. Tiktaalik is probably very widespread. There's a creature from Quebec, from rocks of this age, more or less, that called Alpistostege. It's known from the front end of a skull and a partial skeleton that looks a lot like Tiktaalik. There's a creature called Pandorichthys, which looks from Latvia, Eastern Europe, which looks a lot like a primitive version of Tiktaalik. It's not known as well, but it's good specimens, as high-quality specimens. I also think there's a... I think it's going to change. You know, stay tuned to this channel for the next 5 years. I think the idea is, you know, we now know where to look, how to look. We have the toolkit of places to look. And I think, you know, you're seeing people going out and looking in ways they haven't done before in new places. And I bet you, you'll probably find a Tiktaalik sort of grade of creature fairly common. It's my prediction. I don't have any, you know, this is just me speculating. A Tiktaalik kind of creature. Fairly common in the northern land masses of rocks of this age, once people start looking more seriously. Okay? I'll take one more so we can... Yes?
What's the specific evidence that it had lungs?
There's two lines of evidence. One is it had ribs, and those ribs have joints which suggest they're able to move to support costal breathing. The other is actually that most people think lungs are an advanced feature of fish. They're not. They're very primitive. We actually know lungs were present over 400 million years ago in certain kinds of very primitive fish. We also know that lungs are present in more primitive creatures than Tiktaalik, some of which are alive today, such as lungfish and coelacanths and so forth. So the fact is most fish either have a swim bladder or lungs. And indeed, when you look at fish that live in aquatic environments that sometimes undergo stress in terms of the levels of oxygen in the water, what you find is they evolve all kinds of neat mechanisms to breathe. Sometimes they'll vascularize the back of their throat. Sometimes they'll vascularize the parts of their deeper pharynx, their gut, their swim bladder. I mean, there are about 23 different independent evolution of what we call accessory respiratory organs in fish to breathe air. The lungs are one of those, and they're actually one of the most primitive that we know of.
Well, join me in thanking Neil for a great talk. And I just want to remind you that his book is available here. And buy a copy for a friend. Spread the news. Thanks a lot.
Neil will be available this afternoon in the Geology Museum to sign his book from 1 to 2. So we hope you'll all come over there. Thanks for coming.